reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome some high school students with us today and the technical college students. In fact, we have no high school students as I look at the sheet. We have Southwest Wisconsin Technical College. Would those students please stand?
Good group.
Thank you. We're delighted you're with us. And we have students from St. Norbert College. Would they stand, please?
Nope.
Who are the rest of you? You want to tell us? Department of Corrections. Employees? Interns? Well, we welcome you all. If anyone would like a summary of the case that you are about to hear, we can provide one. You'll find it easier to listen to if you're more familiar with the case. Would you raise your hand if you'd like a summary? The court cannot raise the hands. Okay. Well, welcome. Wait,
You can't raise your hand.
Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. If you wish, at noon or thereabouts after this case, Justice Robinsack will meet with high school students who appeared earlier, and there will be a discussion of the procedures of the court in hearing and deciding cases, not the substantive issue of the case you're about to hear. So you're all welcome. Everyone is welcome to attend. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. I'll now call the second case today, 05AP584CR, State v. John C. Brown. Representing Mr. Brown is Randall Paulson, Assistant State Public Defender. We will then have 10 minutes from Professor Walter J. Dickey of the Law School, representing the amicus curiae. Then we'll have 30 minutes from Assistant Attorney General Eileen Prey, and you have 5 minutes of rebuttal, counsel. All right, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Randall Paulson, representing John Brown, the petitioner. We ask this Court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision and remand this case for a new reconfinement hearing. Several years ago, I was visiting my parents in northern Wisconsin, and they had just received their copy of the Rice Lake Chronotype. The front page article of that newspaper was about the retirement of Barron County Judge James Eaton, and the lead into the headline about that article said, "Sentencing was the toughest part of his job," he said. And I thought that that phrase, "sentencing was the toughest part of his job," spoke volumes about what it means to be a judge in a free society. And I have to think that the citizens of Wisconsin are both proud and reassured to know that judges are challenged by the sentencing decisions that confront them. They're proud to have judges who work hard and who take care when they make decisions involving the liberty of other people, and they're reassured that judges seek the best information they can get and carefully apply facts to governing standards before sending people to jail or to prison. Citizens are reassured that judges explain themselves to the defendants, that they explain themselves to any direct victims and to society at large, and ultimately that they explain themselves to appellate courts who are also interested in the process and provide meaningful review. In this case, the court is going to say for the first time whether the same high standards for imposing original sentences apply when defendants face reconfinement hearings after the revocation of their extended supervision. This court's decision is going to send a clear message to circuit and appellate courts and to the citizens of this state. And I ask the court to issue a decision that's consistent with the central spirit of truth in sentencing legislation, which I believe was to make sentences more transparent, more easily understood, and make judges accountable, and to also harness the age-old abilities that trial judges have to use the well-settled standards for exercising discretion and primary sentencing factors.
Counsel, if that's the case, and you are probably familiar with the Criminal Penalty Sentencing Study Committee, which Professor Dickey served on. Professor Dickey also served on the Wisconsin Sentencing Commission when I was there, so I certainly respect his judgment, and he was an outstanding member. But I wanted to say this, that on page 15, it says that a disposition in hearing is not resentencing. So, as in the red brief, the state distinguishes that, and they say, now look, this very distinguished committee chaired by Tom Barland, there are many other members of which I said Professor Dickey was a member, indicated that the disposition hearing is not a resentencing, and then they say that, I'll just read you one sentence. This will involve the circuit judge in decision-making process consistent with the accountability philosophy underlying truth in sentencing, but with a minimal impact on the judge's time. Now, what the state seems to say, and I'm going to dig out what I think I want to get the correct page number here, but they were making an argument that that it seemed to be, this is on page 15 of the red brief, and they seem to indicate that this is not intended to be a resentencing. So this is what first there was Judge Crawford, and now there's Judge Hancher who's making a decision here. What about that? What about that report and saying that this should not be a full discussion of all of the aspects that took place in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think Swimes, the court decision in Swimes handles most of what you're addressing, because I think the distinction is between the word resentencing and sentencing.
This was a violation. He broke the rules of that he was out on. He sold cocaine, and now and the judge then expresses, he looked at what the DOC recommendation was. He made certain evaluations.
I understand, but the question I think you're asking is what about the reference to reconfinements not being resentencings? And I believe that Swimes looked at the legislative history, a legislative history that the state has not disputed, and the legislative history says that they avoided the use of the word resentencing in order to avoid double jeopardy concerns, but that the whole thrust of the legislative history, and when the Swimes court looked at what the legislature did with McCleary and how the legislature codified McCleary for sentencing and how the legislature has increased the judicial role, that the Swimes court concluded that it is a sentencing, not a resentencing, but that it is a sentencing. And so Swimes says we're going to have 809-30 review of sentencing decisions. And my question is, if it's a sentencing decision and it's reviewable under Chapter 809-30, is that just a semblance of review or is that a full review? For example, if I have an original sentencing, I can challenge it based on inaccurate information under Tiepelman. But if I have a reconfinement sentencing and all of the standards don't apply, do I have the right to a review? Or are we just going to, we're going to have it under the shell of 809-30, but we're not going to have it reviewable for the same thing? But
does it make any difference that this was pre-Galleon?
I think it makes the difference in the sense that this court is going to decide this case under pre-Galleon law in the same way that Taylor has decided. And I'm asking for a reversal because I believe that it is a sentencing, The Court of Appeals, by the way, said it was a sentencing. It just was a sentencing, but not a complete sentencing. It said we don't need to address all relevant factors. The state's taken a slightly different tack in saying, well, it's not really a sentencing. I'm saying it is a sentencing, and that is, and that if you say, if you agree that it's discretionary, that any discretionary determination ever entrusted to trial courts has required full knowledge of the facts and demonstrable application of facts to factors. So in that sense, if you took the state's criteria that they're trying to adapt, either from the pre-1984 era of good time forfeitures or from the 84 to 99 era of reincarcerations, if you took the state's criteria and applied it responsibly, you'd be answering all the same questions as the three factors. So in terms of the pre-Galleon nature of Your Honor's question, I think I'm asking you to reverse because the explanation in this case doesn't even come up to the level that's talked about in paragraph 2 of Galleon, which said that for too long it was considered enough to utter facts, invoke factors, and pronounce a sentence. The facts were not discussed in any length. The judge didn't demonstrate a knowledge of any facts, and there's serious reason to think that he didn't even read information right in the court file in front of him in terms of the
I don't want to take issue. I don't see that. I think this is a quote, an experienced trial judge that's, that is, first of all, and I don't want to go through it point by point, but I think that the position here is that the, if we're talking about, you're saying a sentencing is a sentencing and we shouldn't be looking at reconfinement. And the focus, if you want to go back to McCleary, which is the genesis of Galleon, is that the focus is perhaps not on the gravity of the offense or protection of the public or the rehabilitative needs. And that's what this, that's what the argument the state is making. My position or my point that I'm trying to make here is that since this is pre-Galleon and we have Galleon, is, and the judge did, in my, as I look at this, did discuss the reason that he was picked 3 years. He picked 3 years. Are you saying he should have looked, why is 1.9, which was recommended by the DOC, better than 3? Should he have done that?
Well, no, Your Honor. I think what I'm saying is that we don't, the problem that we, that was confronted in Galleon was really at the end of the sentencing process in terms of the quality of the explanation. I'm saying you don't get to an explanation issue until you have the groundwork of the building blocks of discretion. And he can be a very experienced trial judge, and he's a very honorable trial judge. That's fine. But we have always required that judges have the rudiments, that they know something. I mean, did this judge know that Mr. Brown had no record prior to his original offense? Did the judge know that he was made eligible for treatment in the original sentencing, but he didn't have it? There's just a numerous questions, and they are laid out in the brief, so I won't go at length either. But you know, that's the difference, I think, between decision-making and the exercise of discretion. You know, the courts have been forgiving pre-Galleon, and I think even Galleon leaves some leeway if we believe that a judge undertook a careful analysis, read readily available information about the client, really thought about the client, really thought about the issues, really considered who the client was as a human being, and spent time analyzing the facts in relation to the factors. Then at the end of the process, you know, the 1.9 versus 2 issue, I think the courts have been more forgiving about. But I think that I think we owe something to the citizens of the state that's more detailed than the page of explanation. I mean, and I don't mean disrespect to the court, to the lower court, but I can say I've seen bail hearings where trial judges are well familiar with the defendant's entire record. They're more familiar with the defendant's behavior patterns. They're more familiar with the facts, and they lay it all out. And I think the other thing that's happened, I think, since Galleon, that's eroding Galleon, and that is a problem for this court, is that we, you know, again, it's one thing to draw inferences from silence about the exact finite number. And I can always get tripped up at the extremes of why 2 years instead of 1.5 years. But when we start saying that trial courts don't need to address the primary factors and then we're just going to draw inferences that if it wasn't mentioned, it must not have been important, I think that is departing from what we've always considered in discretion.
Well, counsel, let's talk about that a bit. I know you're talking about the primary factors, and I understand that we have this case to determine what standards, if any, are going to be applied at reconfinement sentencing proceedings. The gist of your argument seems to suggest that reconfinement sentencing proceedings are pretty much the same thing as sentencing proceedings, and we ought to adopt and go through the same factors. But as a pragmatic point, aren't there significant differences between a sentencing proceeding and a reconfinement proceeding in the sense that some of the interests are different? You're not looking necessarily for the same issues. You're not looking at, for example, the McCleary concept of what's the minimum necessary to effectuate the purpose of sentencing, because you've already gone through that and you've had a person who hasn't made it, so you're looking at other factors. There are other issues that weigh in, the institutional adjustments, other factors. So I understand that we're going to be sitting here and trying to wrestle with whether we should have standards for reconfinement, but I'm not certain that it's the same thing as sentencing. So I would like you to expound on why we should adopt all of the McCleary/Guyon standards at a reconfinement proceeding, or whether or not we should be looking at different issues.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I think that the phrase in Guyon, going forward, and I understand it's a pre-Guyon case, but Guyon talks about how the required explanation can vary from case to case. And so I then thought about, does the required explanation or do the standards vary from category of case to category of case, which I think is partly Your Honor's question. And it seems to me that if an appellate court says we are going to categorically differentiate reconfinement hearings, and we're going to tell the trial courts it's usually not important to focus as much on the original offense, for example. It's usually more important to focus on the violation. I think that you will hem in discretion. I mean, I certainly think it's possible for a reconfinement decision to be of a different character in the sense that a reconfinement judge says, I read all 52 pages of the prior judge's analysis. I agree with it. Now I update it. And so in that sense, the explanation might be briefer than an original sentencing explanation. In terms of minimum custody, I don't see much of a difference between a reconfinement hearing and a new crime and a new original sentencing hearing, because I think it's almost analogous to saying, well, you know, you got 5 years the first time you did a burglary, so I don't need to think about whether 5 years when you've done a violation. I think you always have to need to look at what custody is needed to promote the objectives that a trial judge analyzes and identifies. I want to say something else about the categories of...
Counselor, before you do that, can I push you on that point a little bit? That you need to look at what level of confinement is needed to accomplish the objectives. Are the objectives to be accomplished the same in sentencing as those objectives are in reconfinement?
I don't think categorically they are, and I would ask this Court to put that as part of the discretion. I think that's the problem with moving to a different framework and a different set of standards, is that the appellate court, in effect, is saying, you know, you won't need to do as much discretion because we're telling you most of the time it's this way or most of the time it's that way. I think trial judges can say, you know, for example, a person did a very severe crime, but the judge gave him a break, gave him a short stint of initial confinement, and then they had long extended supervision. Now, they only got revoked for a rule violation. Well, what's more important, the minor rule violation of absconding or the fact that the person absconded was a dangerous sex offender? So in that case, you know, in fashioning the objective and looking at everything, the trial court's exercise of discretion might be different. You know, you can get an extended supervision term on a Class B felony of up to 20 years. And so that means you could face revocation of 20 years. At an original sentencing, on taking the lower end of the felony scale, the maximum initial confinement is a year and a half. So you can't categorically say that less time is at issue. And I think common sense would say that if I give you a break one time and you blow it, you might be facing more time. Now, a word about that. The additional time you face when you're revoked for reconfinement might be for a rule violation. At least with an original crime, you always know somebody committed a crime and you're sentencing for a crime. If we say it's usually important what the violation is, I don't think that that's a useful thing to tell trial judges, because somebody could get 20 years of revoked extended supervision just for a rule violation.
Mr. Paulson, I understand that the significance of this case is that we're being asked to set the parameters as far as recommitment hearings. But at the heart of this case, you're asking us to find that there was an erroneous exercise of discretion by the trial court. And I'll tell you why I'm having trouble with that. Just looking at the sentencing statement, and I know Justice Wilcox touched on this, but I want to go a little further. Judge is saying that there's a reason for extended supervision. It's giving you a chance to follow rules and regulations. You didn't do that here. You sold crack cocaine. He's saying the department gave us a recommendation. I think it's too low. He talks about the time that was available, 6 years and 4 months. He says it's going to take you some time because you got a cocaine problem. And so what we're going to do here is, because it's hard to beat, we're going to go beyond what the department recommended. And then he says 3 years out of 6 years and 4 months available. Now, how is that an erroneous exercise of discretion?
I think because it's erroneous ab initio in the sense that we have always required judges to act with full knowledge of the facts. I think you go in almost any case that describes discretion, you're going to find a requirement of full knowledge of the facts. And so, you know, it's anybody that's facing a reconfinement hearing is facing the reconfinement hearing because they got revoked. And so that's much of what he says.
What facts didn't the trial court know?
Well, he didn't know the prior record of the defendant.
Where is that? Should he?
Didn't he have the trial court record before him?
In the 10-page hearing that I read on the reconfinement, nobody tells him what the guy's record is, as would be done at a bail hearing. And he doesn't say that he knows anything about what the guy's record is. So we don't know what he knew. He doesn't demonstrate the knowledge of Mr. Brown's character. I mean, this court has said in Elias versus State that a trial judge has to acquire full knowledge of the character and behavior patterns of a defendant before imposing sentence.
So what you're saying, if there was a 60-page report of the prior sentencing, that the judge should have read that and so indicated that in the record, I have read the previous record and I understand it, would that be enough? What do you want the judge to do? Do you know as a matter of fact whether the record was there, or you're just taking, because he didn't mention it, you're assuming? Well,
I'm assuming that it has always been the judge's obligation to make a record of what they base their decision on, and that's State versus Eccles, that the judge gives the basis for the decision. The judge says, this is what I'm relying on. The judge says, this is what I've consulted. And that in the short and cryptic reconfinement hearing that we have, we just have so little. I guess I've listed it on page 9 through 11 of my brief, the various facts about Mr. Brown, starting on page 9 of my brief. You know, the criminal complaint doesn't say word one about what the original crime was, how it relates to the offense that got him revoked. Doesn't say that he's read the original PSI. I don't know, based on my knowledge of Milwaukee County practice, I don't know if the PSI was still in the court record or not. But I know that the prior sentencing transcript was in the record. And now the state's arguing that even though it's always in the record when somebody goes to prison, this court should tell the circuit courts of Wisconsin, you can send someone up for 9 years or 20 years, and we know that original sentencing transcript's in the file, but we don't think you should bother to read it. And that, I think, is one of the central difficulties that I have with the state's position, because I think that's so corrosive to say even information that's readily available can be just blown right past and ignored. And I see a golden rule problem with the way sentencing discretion or decision making was done in this case, where a guy the judge has never seen before is hailed in front of him. You got 7 pages of transcript, and you know the logic is, you know, you're on supervision, you broke the rules. I think you got a cocaine problem. Doesn't say what he bases that conclusion on.
The charge is selling cocaine, don't you think?
Well, but
he was facing that charge in another branch of the circuit court.
Right, but if I sell 2 rocks of cocaine, do I have a cocaine problem that's going to take me years to beat? A judge might make that judgment about me if he knows my background, but if he knows nothing about me, how do you just make a snap judgment? I think you have a cocaine problem that's going to take you years to beat.
Well, he had the recommendation from the Department of Corrections, and if my understanding is correct, That was 1 year, 10 months, and 30 days. I don't quite understand the 10 months and 30 days.
30 days is like a month.
But in, yeah, right. To me it is.
Yeah.
But in any case, the difference between what was recommended on their grid and what he was giving was, to me, a year and 1 month.
Right.
That's not a huge deviation. You know, and certainly there's a basis for at least assuming that there's a crack cocaine problem when he's faced with the charge of selling crack cocaine.
If we're serious about judicial discretion and it being the judge's decision, I don't think you defend the judge's decision by how it compares to recommendations. If we're serious about saying that those recommendations are not binding, that's one more reason why we are saying that judges have to have a full fund of knowledge.
Well,
and facts.
But it's something that was there in front of him. It's a recommendation that he had, so another factor that he was considering. My problem is, as I said before, erroneous exercise of discretion. I don't see how you get that out of what occurred here.
Well, I would ask the court to go back to McCleary and talk about what they expect before they will uphold a decision that, unless they find evidence of real judgment and judgment that's informed by knowledge of the facts, McCleary says they will disregard the decision. And I just think this is too skimpy of a factual fund of knowledge for a court to have before sending someone to prison for 3 years.
I'm reading now. Our knowledge is derived from the record, what the briefs are. I'm reading from page 4 of the red brief. But when they had the, quote, reconfinement hearing, Brown was represented by counsel. He was given an opportunity to speak. The state, which this is a judge now receiving this information, argued that Brown had received a break in the original sentence because the facts of that offense constituted armed robbery rather than theft. The state suggested that Brown had not taken advantage of the break he was given in sentencing because Brown committed this alleged new felony for selling drugs only 3 months after being released from prison. This is what the judge is hearing. The state believed that Brown's involvement in the drug world could be inferred because the original sentence involved a drug deal or robbery of a drug dealer, and then he's released. He's out very quickly selling drugs to the community once again. Now, Brown's counsel informed the court, this is Judge Hancher, that Brown had not been a party who actually held the gun in the original offense. However, counsel quickly turned to Brown's behavior on supervision. So the judge is listening to this, and what we need to look at is what did Brown do and what happened since the sentencing. And counsel did not urge the court to review the original sentencing transcript or apply standards traditionally considered at sentencing hearing, the gravity of the offense, the character of the offender. Instead, counsel wanted the court to follow the Department of Corrections, which was just referred to by Justice Crooks, recommendation of 1 year, 10 months, and 30 days. So what happened here was that the judge exceeded that recommendation by going another 1 year and 30 days or 1 month, however you want to call it. So his own counsel said that Brown's violation was serious, constituting a new felony for a hand-to-hand drug transaction. However, counsel argued that up to the point of his violation, 3 months after release, the things seemed to be going very well. I mean, is the judge supposed to say, well, this is... I guess what I am trying to say that the judge heard all of this, and for 3 months, Brown kept his appointments, secured his attempted to secure employment, and remained violation-free for 3 months. Now, the judge heard that he had had these, at least you're saying he didn't look at the record. We don't know that. That's just an assumption. But the judge listened to what the state said, what the defense counsel said, and then, and I won't go any further, but when you say he didn't hear anything or didn't have anything, at least we know he had that in front of him, and he was making a decision based on that and the fact that there's no question when the counsel for the defendant says this is a serious violation, selling rock cocaine 3 months and you're out on probation.
So I see my time's expired, but if I can answer.
No, I just wanted to.
Can I answer you?
Yeah.
Thank you. I want to point out that we're now 7 years into truth in sentencing, and this is the decision of this court that's going to say how reconfinement hearings are handled going forward. And so, you know, you can parse together something and make excuses for what was done in this individual case, or you can say this is the kind of methodological framework that we expect going forward. And is it going to be enough to have 6 pages of narrative from the attorneys, or do, if there's readily available independent knowledge in the court file, do we expect the court to demonstrate the knowledge of facts needed to make a decision?
I didn't mean, if you think I'm trying to make an excuse, I'm not trying to make an excuse. I'm just pointing out to you when you say that there was a lack of, you just want more information, you want the judge to take more time.
And demonstrated knowledge.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Paulson, I'm concerned with any standards this court might be looking at to adopt. State on pages 17 and 18 of their brief have suggested that this is, the reconfinement hearings is somewhat akin to what used to take place in the old probation and parole situations, and have suggested that some of the criteria stated in State ex rel Hauser versus Caraballo and in the administrative code, HA 2.05 sub 7 sub F, might provide the type of standards that we might be looking at for purposes of reconfinement proceedings that would enable a court to show that it's exercised its discretion and gone through the thought process necessary for purposes of reconfinement. I guess my question to you is, A, do you agree that these are standards that this court should perhaps look at and consider, as opposed to just McCleary, the full McCleary standards that you've argued for? And B, whether you agree or not, do you think that the sentencing reconfinement judge's disposition in this case meets the standards set forth in Hauser and under the administrative code?
Well, let me start with the last part of that. I don't think it does, because if you read Hauser, Hauser says, as we've said in McCleary, and that element of McCleary of full knowledge of the facts, regardless of how you verbalize the factors, full knowledge of the facts is always number one, if it's discretion, full knowledge of the facts. I think the factors themselves, in terms of the amount of time needed, still kind of subsume all the McCleary factors. So I don't even think it's a matter of just McCleary factors. I think that sentencing, the common law of sentencing, is broad enough to give judges discretion, not only at the end of the process in pronouncing a number, but at the beginning of the process in weighting the factors and in identifying the objectives. And I would also point out that many of these hearings are going to be done at the same time, a new sentencing and a reconfinement in the same hearing. Are we going to add and benefit trial judges by saying, on your new crime, I apply traditional sentencing criteria, and now turning to your reconfinement sentence, I verbalize it differently? To me, you don't get anything. One more word about reincarceration or good time, depending on how far back the state wants to go. It's my understanding, number one, that those were indeterminate reconfinements. Under 5311 sub 7B, the statute section. So that was a little bit of a different decision when you had a parole reconfinement. You'd send somebody back for 3 years, but it was an indeterminate term. The legislature has said things are going to be determinate, things are going to be clear, things are going to be explained, and we're going to give it to judges to do it. And so I think it would be ironic to revert to say, well, let's do it the way the parole board did, in a little squishier fashion and a little looser, a little more informal fashion. That isn't the spirit of truth in sentencing, as far as I'm concerned. So to sum up, I think that the sentencing factors are going to be broad enough. The explanation can be tailored and simple enough under Galleon's provision that required explanation can vary. But that varies by case, not by category. Because you have very serious, complicated reconfinement hearings, you have very simple original sentencing hearings. And so I don't think this court will help lower courts by trying to make false distinctions and categorizing things. So I think that the court, if you want to get something that, as a practical matter, the courts can implement in their busy calendars, I think they shouldn't be skimping. I don't think they should have just minimal time when it comes to learning about the human being they're sentencing. But I think adding a new set of verbalizing standards that really gets you to the same question, I don't think is going to help.
Mr. Polson, Justice Prosser has a question.
Could I ask you two fact questions? The Department of Corrections recommendation, could you describe that? How long was it? What was in it? And number two, as I understand it, Mr. Brown went from this reconfinement hearing to another court, Judge Seifert's court. What happened there?
Okay, do you want me to answer the latter part, even though it's not in the record? Okay. He got 8 months consecutive time for the new offense. So that's the answer to that. And so that's how that court weighed out that punishment, and I don't know whether how much that judge in turn knew about what happened the same day before.
8 months consecutive to what and where?
He got eight months. I imagine he would, if it was pronounced as 8 months, it would have been 8 months house of correction time, but under the rules it would have been served in prison because he was serving prison time, and he's presently at Thompson Correctional Institution, and it was consecutive to 3 years. In terms of the DOC recommendations, that's an attempt to, in one sense, it's kind of an attempt to standardize things in the sense that we just take percentages. But on the other hand, it is tagged a little bit to the original discretion that the trial judge issued because the percentage they take is the percentage of extended supervision that was imposed, and that was a judicially determined amount. So it is still somewhat tagged to the original sentencing decision, I would say.
What I'm really trying to get at was what was in this document. Was it one page, 3 pages, 5 pages?
It was not a long document. I believe the whole court memo was just a couple of pages. I'm fumbling for it.
What's at page 113 of your brief? Is that the right page? Sorry, I was referring to the Court of Appeals, but there's a Department of Corrections Court memo. Is that part of this? A letter?
I don't know if that's in my
appendix. August 26, 2004.
Right.
I guess what I'm really getting is I'd like to know
it's a three-page document, the court memo. And do you want the record cite for it?
As I understand it, there are a lot of people from the Department of Corrections here. Should we be thinking about the Department of Corrections recommendation in a situation like this being almost like a pre-sentence investigation?
I think there are different ways of doing it. I mean, in some counties, the original pre-sentence is there and could be easily updated. I know the pre-sentences I know are used in the Department of Corrections when they staff people, as are original sentencing transcripts, by the way, which I would think would be one more reason why the courts should care about the original sentencing transcript. But logistically, I think there are a number of ways to – I'm not as much concerned, Your Honor. I know you are and need to be, and I am concerned about information getting there. I'm not as much concerned about the how as just that it get there. And I guess what is concerning to me is the message to circuit courts. If there is thinking and analysis about the original crime and the character of the offender and the need to protect the public, and that's done by a fellow judge, and it's recorded, and it's in the court file, and we require the prisons to think about it, to then have a reconfinement hearing and say, oh, no, this your time is too valuable. But, you know, it's going to cut both ways if a judge makes an ill-informed decision. Part of the decision is whether to bifurcate. You know, are we going to just, you know, in Mr. Brown's case, he's going to get out someday, and a lot of these people are going to get out. And the question is going to be, do we let him out just totally free, or do we stage it so that you're locked up and then on supervision and then out? And so that's an important part of the discretion that needs to be done here. And so these are very important decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Mr. Dickey?
Your Honor, I should mention some of the other people here are law students. They are the ones who were too quiet to identify themselves.
Okay, why don't they all stand? That'll show them.
should also say that my class is listening in on their computers to this, because I moved up sentencing as our consideration this semester, gave them Galleon, gave them the briefs in this case, and we've been talking about these issues.
Well, we welcome all in interest.
In cyberspace as well as in practice. That's a way of asking you not to embarrass me in front of my students.
A challenge to do so.
It might be helpful to the court if I said a word or two about why I think this case is so important. For the past 3 or 4 years now, 65% of the people coming into prison every year have been coming in on revocations of probation and parole. You might think they're coming straight from court having been sentenced, but actually the majority, 65%. Now, that's doubled since 1987 when I left corrections, when the number was about 30%. I think a second very important fact here is if you follow the publications of the Sentencing Commission and you notice the durations of the extended supervision that judges are typically giving out, what you see is they're giving out large hunks of extended supervision. Not uncommon sentences are 5 years of confinement, 10 years of extended supervision. Now, in the particular case at hand, it's true that there was a relatively short period of time from the initial sentencing to the moment that's at issue in this case. But I think it's worth noticing that in an awful lot of the cases, it's quite possible, perhaps likely, that there may be 10 or 15 years between the original sentencing and whatever we're calling this reconfinement or resentencing. I don't really think it matters. My point is really that given all of that time and all of the behavioral things that could have happened both in prison and in the community, the facts and circumstances that could have changed could really lead a sentencing judge to have a different purpose at this moment, being mindful of the many facts that could have developed and changed during that period. And it seems to me, therefore, incumbent upon the trial judge to revisit the purpose of the sentence, whether it is to reiterate that the original purpose was one that was properly identified and continues to be the purpose, or whether it really should be altered, or if the purpose isn't altered, perhaps the means would be altered. I say the means would be altered because in our brief we imagined what we thought would be an acceptable explanation. But actually you can imagine other explanations that the judge might have given on the facts of this case as I understand them. The judge might have said deterrence was my principal instrument for trying to achieve public safety in this case. It appears deterrence has been a weak instrument so far. I feel, therefore, it's going to have to be surrounded by other assists or other resources that are going to be mobilized if public safety is going to be served in this particular case. The judge might have said that given the fact that the guy was unemployed, that his spare time was unaccounted for, that his living arrangements were not very stable, that one of the things that the judge would want to revisit at this moment is the conditions that the person goes to when they return to extended supervision, one of the duties of the judge, and say that he's going to require the Department of Corrections to see to it that the guy's got a job.
Professor
got a stable
Mickey,
place
if
to
I can interrupt you for a minute, does it make a difference that you're dealing with a different judge? In this particular situation, it's my understanding that it was Judge Crawford who imposed the original sentence. It's now Judge Hancher on the recommitment hearing. Doesn't that make a difference?
I think it can. The point that I was really trying to make is the factual circumstances around this decision can vary greatly from the same judge close to the time of sentencing to a different judge, as you say, close to the time of sentencing, to a different judge very distant from that moment.
Professor Dickey, my question would go to the fact that, as I explained to counsel, or I read from the one of the briefs here, in 3 months after this person is out on the street, and I heard what you said, it may be 10 or 15 years, and I certainly think that's a good idea. But here it appears that he was told 3 months. So he was out, he's selling drugs, he's selling crack cocaine, and the judge said that returning Brown to the community would present a too high of a risk. So he was assessing that. I mean, should In this case, because of the short time that he was out, it would be a different consideration than it would be if the person had been 10 or 15 years.
I think that the judge at this moment could certainly and responsibly have attended to the duration that he should go back to prison for and the conditions that should surround him when he returns to the community. Because the judge is setting the moment when he's going to return to the community when he says 3 years. And since the original responsibility of the judge is to identify the conditions of extended supervision, it seems to me the changing facts and circumstances, the new crime, might suggest to the judge that he needs to rethink the circumstances to which the person is going to return, because the ones that he returned to in the first place certainly seem unsatisfactory from a public safety point of view.
My question is this. Aside from this case and whether or not the judge erred here, what should the court be saying about reconfinement? Should it treat it, it's not the original sentencing, it's a subsequent, call it what you will, but it's either going to keep him out or put him in, and there's going to be a time frame. So what should an what should this court require of the judge, regardless of whether it's the same judge, 3 months or 10 years?
I think what the court should require of the judge is identification, reiteration perhaps, of the purpose of the sentence, an identification of the strategies that are going to be applied to try to effectuate that purpose. I mentioned deterrence as the one connected to public safety. And then an analytical, factual explanation of why the decision reached in this case is the one it is and why it's going to advance that purpose. See, what concerns me, Judge, is that I've long been an opponent of grids and the mechanics of the federal system, because you shove in numbers and you make factual findings, but there's no analytical connection made between the values attached to those numbers and the facts that are plugged in. And what worries me is that we're going to adopt grids without grids. We're going to say facts, we're going to say a number, but there's not going to be an analytical or explanatory connection between them. And it seems to me it's the explanatory stuff, which I think McCleary set forth and I think Galleon strongly reiterated, that we've got to look for in this case. And I think it's particularly important, not only because of the public safety concerns and the financial concerns, because we're talking about a lot of money here, $90,000 of the taxpayer's money in this particular case, but also because the legitimacy of court's sentencing is really at stake here. I grant you there's a lot of rhetoric around truth in sentencing, but one of the good things about it was the idea it was going to shed light on these important decisions, make them as clear as possible. And I think to say we're going to go back to the old parole board method really isn't good enough if it's going to be courts doing these things in open court, because I think both the defendant and the public deserve and reasoned explanation. And as we tried to show in that sort of imagined one, I don't think it's all that time-consuming. It just really takes attention. And it also takes something that I think has been missing in a lot of these cases, and that's advocacy. And I think one of the reasons advocacy has been missing is because the standards for review have not been clear and certain enough. And in a sense, all of the advocacy has been debased, and it doesn't position conscientious trial judges to go through the analytical process that I'm talking about.
Well, the reconfinement hearing here was just argument by both counsel. And as I read it in the appendix and I reread it this morning, and the facts that are brought out in the briefs about what factors might have been considered were not brought out there. They just were not. They're brought out here, but they weren't brought out before the trial court.
I'm disturbed. I can't say that I'm as close to it as I wish I were, but I think the level of advocacy around these kinds of matters is not what it should be. The factual development is not what it should be. Instead, as Judge Momstead once said, we get the speeches. And we don't need the speeches. We need the facts, and we need the analysis that supports the inferences and conclusions that the judges reach. And I really think the judges are trying to be conscientious here, and I think what has to happen is we have to help them do that.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Dickey, I've got a two-part question, and I'm thinking in terms of whether or not the court should be adopting standards, and if so, what type at a reconfinement proceeding. Should a reconfinement sentencing judge be required to review a sentencing court transcript, and what level of deference, if any, should be given to a Department of Corrections recommendation?
Excuse me. On the question of the Department of Corrections recommendation, I think we need to know more about where it comes from. See, in this particular case, one view, which I hope would be true, is that it is a reflection of norms, right? I don't think we can say the Department of Corrections knows the community's norms, but it's trying to reflect them back to the court. And it's probably also trying to reflect other values back to the court when it makes a recommendation. To that extent, I think that recommendation has value, in part because it affords the court a benchmark against which it can judge whether in this case the norms that are being identified should be deviated from, either up or down. And in the present case, there's reason to deviate up. It's not a given that it should have been 1 year, 9 months, and 30 days, or whatever that was. But it does really afford you a comparative figure that I think is really good if you're trying to ask what punishments deserved, for example, because this is identification of what other cases presumably have gotten that are like this one. And now you can go up or down depending on how you view the seriousness of it. I'm sorry, your first question.
Review the, should the free confinement judge review the sentencing judge's sentencing transcript?
I think that what the reconfinement judge should see is that portion of the transcript at least where the McCleary-Gallion standard was explained and met. It seems to me that's the part of crucial importance. And if the trial judge reviews that, and if there is advocacy around that, and pointing out what circumstances have changed or facts have changed around that, and why the judge would make a particular decision with reference to it, that seems to me of central importance.
Resentence investigation, too?
I wouldn't say that the whole pre-sentence has to be looked at by the judge. I think one of the things that judges have got to do, and perhaps it's really for this court to do in this particular case, is to identify what things are for the advocates to do and what things are for the judges to do. I think one of the unfortunate sort of circumstances, whether it's around guilty pleas or other things, is we're asking judges to do an awful lot of things that we should be asking the lawyers to do. And it seems to me that any decision of this court that is going to sort of lay out what the future should be has got to draw some distinctions between what we expect of the lawyers by way of highlighting and pointing out, showing what facts and circumstances have changed, what's relevant and what's not, and what we say the sentencing judge should unilaterally be doing. I think asking a whole lot of the judges to unilaterally do is probably not wise. We need to require lawyers to do their jobs.
You make some very compelling arguments here, but when you say, I don't think this is going to take that much time, I have trouble swallowing that.
Well, Judge, you know, on time, when I said before 3 years, $90,000 of the taxpayers' money, when I think about spending $90,000 of my own, if I had it, I take some time. And why I wouldn't take similar time when I was spending the taxpayers' money is a little hard to explain if you're a public servant. I do think these are important decisions, both individually in terms of safety and in terms of money. But I also do think that if this court launches the development of a common law around the subjects that we're talking about, what you're going to see is much greater efficiency over time as courts and lawyers start to develop some facility with this. Right now, because it tends to be so mushy, it looks sort of overwhelming in what it might take. I grant you, I think in the early stages, it's probably going to take time as these things sort of settle and sort out. But over time, one would hope that efficiencies would really develop here, particularly as judges get experienced.
But just one last question. You said you didn't like the federal grid system. I think I certainly agree with you. But a grid system showing a mean, some tool for the judge to use, Wisconsin used, I don't know if they have, they're putting them out now, but we used to have them, and that was in the old system indeterminate.
Yes.
But I felt that that was at least a tool showing what the norm is and what the judge could use and what's happening in different places. And that, are you saying that that system also would not be helpful?
No, Judge. I think we ought to provide the sentencing judges with all the information we can to arm them to make good decisions. And I think the kind of information the Sentencing Commission that we were on afforded judges was helpful because it really showed them where similarly situated people ended up. It showed them where people who deviated this way and that way ended up. And it really gave you a reference point for making a decision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dickey. Eileen W. Prey, Assistant Attorney General representing the State Council.
Good afternoon. this court is asked today to set standards for reconfinement hearings and standards of review. It's something new in Wisconsin law. It's not a sentencing. It is, I think it's important to step back and look at the statutory language. That's where this all came from. Under the original TIS-1, the statutory language was almost identical, but it said that after revocation of extended supervision, the administrative law judges would make this kind of decision on reconfinement. And the decision is how much time a person will be sent back to prison within the amount that's left on the original bifurcated sentence. All that was done in TIS-2 was changing that decision maker to the judiciary. It didn't change the kind of decision that was. It didn't change, it didn't subscribe or prescribe any kind of hearing procedures. It didn't relate it to sentencing. And I want to make clear, I think the judges in this state are looking for guidance. There wasn't anything out there. They're trying to fit a round peg into a square hole by going back to the sentencing factors because that's what they're familiar with. Instead, the state suggests that what they should be looking at are the kind of factors that have been used for many, many, many years, back into the 70s, for these kind of forfeiture hearings, reincarceration hearings after revocation of parole. And that system is not gone. That system will be around for revocation of parole for a long time because there are a lot of people in the system who are still convicted under the old and older law. So that those standards are being used. It's also the kind of standards that were used by the administrative law judges under TIS-1 when they were making these specific kinds of decisions on reconfinement after extended supervision.
Ms. Prey, if I could, one of the concerns that I have about the state's position, I certainly would have no problem with the concept that a reconfinement hearing is different than an original sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding of TIS and TIS-2 is also that we were eliminating parole, and that what we were doing is saying as part of the truth in sentencing process that we were putting the hands of the decision-making into the putting decision-making into the hands of the judges.
Yes.
So in doing so, while it may be a different type of sentencing proceeding, I still nevertheless see that there is sentencing involved. In fact, the actual language used by the court during the pronouncement of the sentence is that they are giving a sentence. So,
and I'm sorry.
It's not quite the same thing as parole. What I'm trying to get a handle on is what are the differences and where should we be looking at in terms of providing guidance to the trial courts and how to handle these reconfinements that aren't really parole hearings.
Right. First, I'd like to say I think it's a mistake to consider these sentencing because in the past people have been not so careful about their terminology. Judges talk about sentencing because that's what they're familiar with. They've never been asked to do this kind of reconfinement hearing before. The subcommittees for the study committee talked about sentencing because they weren't using careful terminology. When it came down to the fact of having to decide what the study committee was going to recommend here, they very carefully said it was not a sentencing. There's some mention of double jeopardy concerns, but to me that means it's not a sentencing. It's not creating a new penalty for the original offense. Now, to try to answer your question about, so what is the difference, I guess, is that what your question is? What is the difference whether we call it a reconfinement hearing or sentencing? What is the practical difference for the judges in our states? I think one practical difference is generally the focus is going to be different. The focus, although it is true, and I'm not arguing with Mr. Paulson that it is true that sometimes the severity of the original offense will be important, but generally the focus is going to be on the person's behavior while they were on supervision and whether they were able to be successful on that supervision. And it's a much more focused kind of decision. And there, except in rare occasions, will there be a real need for the circuit courts to go back to the original sentencing transcript, to go back to the original PSI. Those were the broad kind of factors that that court, the original court, took into consideration in imposing sentence and putting the parameters on this sentence. We've got an individual now who was sentenced, went out on, did their confinement time, went out on ES, and failed on supervision.
Shouldn't a trial, a reconfinement judge, however, be concerned about the original purposes of sentencing in trying to ascertain what degree of reconfinement to impose down the road? I mean, isn't that a factor that a court should take into account? It's not just, I mean, yes, the focus is on subsequent behavior, but it's not just the subsequent behavior. You still have issues of deterrence. You still have issues of rehabilitation. You have still have issues of punishment that you want to impose, not just for the behavior on supervision, but also for the behavior for the original offense. So it would seem to me that it would make sense that the trial court, the reconfinement court, would want to know why the sentencing court did what it did in imposing sentence so that the reconfinement would be in line with the purposes of the original sentence, or am I getting that all wrong?
No, I think I understand what you're saying, and I think in the perfect world, with all the time in the world, that we would like the circuit court judges to be able to read the sentencing transcript and the PSI and get all the available information. It's not a perfect world, and as Professor Dickey said, there are a lot of these cases, and that's going to be a great stress on the circuit courts of our state, and it was not the intent of the legislature to put a great stress on the circuit courts of our state. And another thing that Professor Dickey said that I really agree with is you've got to put some of the responsibility on the advocates, and in this case, and in many cases, the defense counsel was very focused on the person's behavior on supervision, did not go back to the original, try to argue that something from the original sentencing transcript was important to the imposition of the confinement time, and neither did the prosecutor. And I think the reason in this case is because it was so clear that a person who's been out on supervision for 3 months and can't make it, that that is the critical factor, and that that is what the focus of that decision should be.
Seems to me that the focus of 3 months might go the other way, that short time, unemployment, crisis is explained in the DOC report within the unit, the family unit, put pressure on him, and that had he had a longer time, not been caught, he might have been fine. Now, the DOC says he was not, although he was had some felonies, it didn't seem like he was on the life of crime before, but now 3 months and he's on the life. And the court says to both counsel, as I understand it, you've all read, doesn't say it precisely this way, you've all read the DOC report, any corrections, right? And then goes on from there, and that they don't really discuss it very much.
I respectfully disagree that if somebody can't make it for 3 months on the streets without a violation,
we don't have to debate it. That would have been for the debate in the trial court.
Right, right.
But what then, and I'm trying to get this from defense counsel and from Professor Dickey, and so I'll ask you, what instructions does this court give the trial court as to what the trial court should be doing on these reconfinement? And they are subject to appeal, right?
Yes, they are.
So we have to worry, not only does the trial court make a record, because we're exercising discretion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trial court's exercising discretion.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
So the general rule in exercising discretion is you have to do it within the law, not make a mistake of law, and look at the facts.
Right.
And be rational in the facts to the law. That's McCleary and every other discretion case.
Right.
Okay. So we know that the trial court has to exercise discretion. So what are the factors it should look at in exercising discretion? And so that's the way of making sure that the trial court reaches a good result, that is, one that's supported. But discretion and the record is also important for an appellate court. If there isn't a good statement of the exercise of discretion by the trial court, it's very difficult for us to review that. And then we get into another issue of independent review that we don't need to reach. So, okay, from the state's standpoint, if you were writing this opinion, what would you have the court tell the trial judges
how to handle
reconfinement?
I would tell the trial judges that the factors that they should be looking at are the factors in the administrative code under 2.06, but that those factors are the kinds of things that they should be looking at. But what I really hesitate in this case is that I don't want that to come as a direction to the court that there's going to be some kind of mandatory checklist that they're going to have to go through each one of those factors in every case. I think Justice Wilcox talks about the mandatory checklist problems in Galleon, and that each case is going to be very different, and some of the factors will apply in some cases, some in other cases, some will be more important. Those factors are, I think, at the forefront most often is going to be the person's behavior on supervision, whether they had a long period of supervision without violation, whether they had many violations, whether they had alternative to revocations that they failed at, whether this is one of several revocations in the same case. So those sorts of things. You look at their conduct in prison. Did they have a lot of conduct reports? Or alternatively, were they successful in treatment and other programming? In some cases, As Mr. Paulson suggested, maybe there'll be a situation where the person had a very serious crime, sexual assault, homicide, was out on supervision for a long period of time, had a minor violation, but not so minor that they did not revoke them, but major enough to be revoked. And in that case, the seriousness of the original offense will be a primary factor. The overriding, I guess, concerns will be that the confinement time be sufficient so it doesn't depreciate the seriousness of the violation, that it protects the public from further violations, and that it allows for some confined treatment. And then there should also be a concern about whether this person is going to need some ES time after doing the reconfinement in order to reintegrate themselves into the public, without.
You list the factors in 206.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's a relevant consideration for the court to consider the factor of the past record of criminal offenses?
It may be relevant in a particular case. I think generally those are the kinds of things that the original sentencing judge will look at in setting the parameters of the sentence.
What's the max this defendant could have had in resentencing?
6 years. In resentencing? In reconfining? It was 6 years, 4 months, and some days.
Okay, let's say I'm hard-hearted Hannah, and I'm going to do the 6 years.
Yeah, right.
6 years and 4 months. Okay, as a circuit court judge sitting there, I think that I'd want to know the past record of criminal offenses if I'm considering sending this person to 6 years. I mean, it makes a difference what kind of criminal record he has. Don't you think so?
Well, if that's important to the circuit judge, they can find that information out. If it's important to the prosecutor or the defense counsel, if, for instance, the person had a very minor record or no record at all, it's the defense counsel can bring that out.
What do you mean, if it's important? I mean, I guess you don't know if it's important until you ask the question. There's a difference in my mind if someone has been in prison 3 prior times and has run up 12 felony charges as opposed to the underlying offense being the first offense. I mean, what I am getting at is I look at the Harris factors,
mm-hmm.
and I just don't see why most of those Harris factors aren't things that I would want to know as a circuit court judge. The past criminal record, the vicious or aggravated nature of the crime. It makes a big difference to me if a sexual assault, the underlying offense, is touching the breast or if it's forcible rape. I mean, that makes a big difference to me.
Sure.
Why wouldn't I want to know that if I'm sending someone to 6 years or could maybe send them only, I had up to 6 years to send them.
And you may in a particular case. Even the Harris factors are not a list of mandatory factors that the circuit court judge has to consider in every case.
Absolutely. But we're talking in this case about setting some standards, some factors, things to consider. And frankly, I think those are things, if I were sitting as a circuit court judge, I would want to know about the aggravated and vicious nature of the prior conduct. I would want to know about his criminal history. I would want to know about his, his rehabilitation efforts. I would want to know about history of undesirable behavior, his personality characteristics and traits. I mean, these are factors that we have had for years and years and years, and not that everyone is important. You know, different cases, they'll vary differently. But I think that list is as good as gold. I mean, because as I was sitting as a circuit court judge, I'd want to know those things.
Well, I would suggest that the list in the administrative code has many of those factors
sure,
in it, too.
Sure.
I would say the difference between the two lists is more in focus and attention. The lists that the state is proposing are more focused on the seriousness of the violations and the person's conduct on supervision. The list from Harris are more focused on the person's criminal record and criminal background,
personality
that goes into the original sentencing decision.
I'm not saying conditions since release aren't important, you know, or what went on in the institution are important. But please don't preclude me from considering his history of his past criminal record or his history of undesirable behavior or his personality traits. I mean, if I'm going to send someone to prison for 6 years, I want to know that stuff.
And the state is not suggesting that a court can't consider those. I think what we're suggesting is that the administrative code provisions are a better starting guideline. And again, reiterating that they're not a mandatory type checklist that has to apply in every case.
If you're using the administrative code and concentrating on conduct in prison and conduct out, then it seems to me you should be advocating that there be, I don't want to get into great weight, due weight, no weight, sometimes weight, civil deference standards. But it seems to me then you should pay a lot of attention to the Department of Corrections, because that's what they're analyzing. They're analyzing what he did in prison and what he did in the 3 months thereafter.
Well, I think it's up to the court to look at that recommendation and to judge how much thought went into that recommendation and whether it was more than just applying the 30% or whatever percentage. And then there is also another problem here, which is that the judge in this case is supposed to be a neutral, detached person who is deciding the reconfinement time. With all respect, the Department of Correction isn't a neutral and detached party in this kind of situation. They prosecuted, if you can use that term, the revocation. They are also the agency that is in control of, maybe not control of, but most concerned with crowding prisons. And those are the kind of concerns, actually, that is mentioned in the study committee report, why the decision-making was transferred to the judge, so that they wouldn't be as influenced by the resources that are being taken up, will be taken up by all the reconfinement times. So that, yes, I do think that a court should look at the recommendation and consider it, but certainly the court should use their own judgment on whether this is something that they think is a valid point or not.
Could I ask, at the reconfinement hearing, there's been talk about the importance of advocacy.
Yes.
At that hearing, is there sometimes a pending criminal charge, if it is a criminal offense that led to the revocation? Unresolved criminal charge?
Yes, there can be criminal charges that either are resolved before or after the revocation. It happens both ways.
I mean, the fact that a criminal charge has not been resolved, if that's the facts.
And that was in this case, yes. He hadn't been sentenced on the criminal charge in this case.
I mean, does that confine what counsel might be able to say in argument or not? At the reconfinement hearing.
I'm not understanding that it would. I'm trying to figure out what kinds of things that a counsel wouldn't be able to say because there's a pending criminal charge.
If counsel is representing the defendant at a future criminal trial where facts have not been found,
right,
might be a little reluctant to admit anything.
True. Admit the violation. I don't see that would be very relevant to the reconfinement decision. I mean, there will be the fact that the person was revoked on the basis of that, and there will be the revocation history. The same sorts of things happen in revocations now, parole revocations, where the person is represented by perhaps the same counsel as in a new crime.
Ms. Bray, given the factors that you think a judge should be looking at,
yes,
and then looking at the reconfinement or recommitment hearing that occurred here, what is your position in regard to whether or not this judge in this case was involved with an erroneous exercise of his discretion?
Well, I think Judge Hampshire properly exercised his discretion. It was a concise statement, but it certainly wasn't the kind of mechanistic citing of factors that this court was concerned about in Galleon. Judge Hampshire zeroed in on what was most concerned to him, which was protection of the public and deterrence. He wanted to send a message to Mr. Brown, and he wanted to protect the public from violent drug dealing in Milwaukee. And what he used, he used those two objectives for the reconfinement time. And he looked at the fact that here you had a person who had been given a lengthy time of extended supervision and warned at the time that that was imposed that he could, if he messed up, serve all of that time. This person did mess up very soon after being released and violated, and not just a minimal violation, but a new felony for the same type of offense that he was originally sentenced for. And then there was some question of whether there were AODA treatment needs. So the Judge Hanser then took that information. He then looked at the DOC recommendation, he didn't ignore it, and said that he thought it was too low, that what amounted to close to 2 years was not enough to protect the public and for deterrence, and that he felt that 3 years were necessary to meet those objectives, and that then there would be 3 years plus for extended supervision afterwards to allow for reintegration. And I think that's all that's required. I think that he properly exercised his discretion. I do think that these kind of decisions where you're talking about the liberty interests being less, and they are less, you're taking a person, not a free person who's being sentenced, you're taking a person who's been on conditional liberty and violated the rules of that liberty, and they're being returned, that these kind of hearings can be less formal and should be less formal than a full-blown sentencing hearing. That's what Morrissey contemplated. That's what this court contemplated in Ex Rel Flowers. I've been
counsel. Once again, those are. I understand your argument, but those are parole revocation proceedings.
Yes.
And as I understand, the whole point behind TIS and TIS II, it was to get rid of parole and bring about a new level of decision making by courts. So I'm not sure that the Flowers and Morrissey analogy quite works here.
Well, I think if you're talking about the interests of the offender, they are very relevant because the interests of the offender are nearly identical. In both cases, you've got people who have been on supervision under the rules of the department, in the department's custody. They violated those rules, and now you're making the decision on how much of the original sentence they're going to be reconfined for. They're identical. The interests, as far as I'm concerned, are identical. And the only reason that we're talking about this is one of a rare instance where the revocation decision is being severed from the reincarceration decision. That, as far as I know, doesn't happen in any other context. And so we are left with trying to figure out what does that mean. And as far as the state's concerned, it means that the judge makes the decision, and that's what it means. It doesn't change the flavor, the focus of the decision, just the person who is making the decision.
So Wisconsin did not get rid of parole then?
It certainly did. Yeah. Yes, it did. Of course. It did. But and maybe what you're talking about is that it is technically correct that a person who has been revoked on parole and goes back and is reincarcerated is technically eligible for another discretionary parole. The practical effect of that is that that doesn't happen very often because they've already demonstrated that they're not able to make it on supervision, and oftentimes they're deferred to their release date. That really is the only difference that I can see between the two situations, and I'm talking about only about these reconfinement situations. And in fact, I would be concerned that whatever the court decides today, and if the court decides that this is a sentencing and that sentencing standards apply and that there are mandatory checklists or whatever, that under equal protection we'll be getting claims that people who have been revoked on parole and reincarcerated need to have the same kind of protections. Because as far as I'm concerned, the interests are very close and they're very much in the same situation.
Could I focus, it seems to me in a larger context, we're being asked to consider what information a judge ought to have before the judge says a word, and then what the judge says when he makes a decision, or she makes a decision.
Yes.
What does the normal judge in a situation like Judge Hanscher was in, what does that person normally have right in front of them or right at readily available?
That's a good question, and I think it probably varies depending on how the person got to the reconfinement hearing. And I don't know this for a fact, but I'm thinking if a person actually went through the revocation process that there might be more of a record for the circuit court judge than in this case the person waived the revocation hearing. But there will be, in the case of a person who's waived, they'll get a report from the Department of Corrections. And in the case of a person who actually went through a revocation, they will get something from the administrative law judge. I personally haven't seen what that record looks like.
But I mean, is the entire file of the original case going to be there, including the
piece? I don't know the answer to that question.
Might vary from county to county, probably.
It could be. I don't know that. According to Mr. Paulson, and I have no reason to feel that that's not true, that the court would have access, if they needed it, to the original sentencing transcript and the PSI. So, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Paulson. I think there's a statute that requires a record accompanying prisoners so that in these cases where a person has been to prison once, there has to be a sentencing transcript at the institution, and then there's a Supreme Court rule that says that that sentencing transcript, the original of it, must be in the court file.
No, the question, though, is did this whole file that we have here,
right here.
Which includes the original proceedings, did Judge Hanscher have all of that?
I believe he would have.
On the record, on the bench.
Right, yes, I believe he would have had the judgment roll, everything that was filed in that court file. What I had said earlier was I wasn't sure about the PSI, and I'm targeting Milwaukee County when I answer that, because in Milwaukee County, the PSI is produced and then it's not held in the court files. I think that has something to do with space issues, because as post-conviction counsel, I always have to reapply to get it. And in this case, I know that there was a sentencing in 02, I believe in March of 02, and then there's some docket entry you'll see in the record where the PSI was received into inventory 6 months later, and I can't honestly tell the court whether received into inventory means that it had been in the court file and then went into some other inventory or back to the DOC, but I know oftentimes that would be a step the court would have to take to get the PSI. But, you know, under Reynolds with probation revocations, Reynolds requires taking that step and ordering the transcript, because Reynolds says in the after probation
revocation. Who orders the transcript?
I'm sorry?
Who orders the transcript? I mean, you're taking the step and ordering the transcript. Is that up to the judge?
In the Reynolds situation?
No, I'm just in your situation. You're suggesting that the judge read this material. Should he order it? He or she?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that in this reconfinement situation, by operation of law, that transcript is already in the court file.
Okay. So the point, I want to get back to this, and I think Professor Dickey brought this up. The responsibility is on the advocates here, the prosecutor, the defense counsel. What was argued in front of Judge Hancher? You're suggesting that that isn't enough, that the judge has to go outside of the record that's presented to him in court and get other material, right? Isn't that what you suggested?
Well, I'm suggesting that there's a leadership role for the court to know whether it knows enough. You know, I need to know as a judge whether I have enough knowledge. Now, you can direct counsel to give you more knowledge. And I should say, Your Honor, I didn't mean to be impolite before in saying that you were making excuses. I'm simply saying that I think that we've been flying blind.
I have much more impolite things said to me. I didn't even take that as don't worry about it.
I'm happy to hear that.
Take care of it.
My colleagues will take care of it.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Right.
They'll take care of me in a few minutes.
present justice is excluded, I think.
Of course.
Included, I would say. But in any event, the suggestion, as a former trial judge, and one that I think is, I don't know if you know this, but I was on the sentencing commission for this state from the time of its inception until I went on the Supreme Court, appointed by both Tony Earl and Tommy Thompson. The point is, I want to be nonpartisan here. The point is that what you're suggesting seems to me to be a real step one way or the other, because a judge in Milwaukee County in the sentencing, and particularly in this type, would have to be reading literally dozens of pages outside of the record and then saying, discounting what you have to say, counsel, I read in the record. That puts the judge in sort of an advocacy role, because usually you're presented with the arguments of counsel and then you make a decision. And it seemed to me your suggestion was beyond that.
The overarching theme I have here is that, you know, these are not going to save a lot of time. This isn't going to be easy. This added workload is never, you know, in my job I have people say, you have to do this extra, but it won't be a lot of extra time. And that was said, but I think if you have a whole new category of reconfinements, it is a burden on the circuit court's time. My overarching theme is that if you put it into the context of sentencing, and if you tell counsel, treat it as seriously as you would treat a sentencing, then counsel knows that the judge is supposed to be concerned about what the prior judge knew. That transcript is readily available in the file. And my support for saying that this is a sentencing, by the way, and something the state hasn't refuted, it's at page 5 of my reply brief, quoting Swimes, 277, was second at 418. It is clear from the legislative history that the drafters of this reconfinement statute routinely used the term sentencing to describe the order of recommitment following revocation of a prisoner's extended supervision. And so I think that if this court, to invent something different, you're going to either have to contravene the legislature or you're going to have to say that Swimes was incorrect in how it read the legislative intent. The legislature has given over a tremendous amount of decision-making authority to the courts and has called it sentencing. And as I listened to the state listing all the factors, I was impressed by the fact that when the state lists all the things that might go into one of these decisions, these are important decisions. And these important decisions can be made within the same rubric without burdening the trial courts with a whole different set of criteria. Thank you very much.
Counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Mr. Paulson, Mr. Dickey, and Ms. Prey for their arguments today on our first reconfinement issue, but not our last, on resentencing or on sentencing. That ends our hearing on 05-AP-584-CR, State v. John C. Brown. The court will reconvene in closed session at 2:30. Those who wish to stay and hear a discussion of the procedures of the court should remain in the room.
Stay.